Welcome to Poetry Tea Time, the podcast sponsored by A Brave Writer's Life in Brief. I'm Julie Bogart, your host. This is episode 20. The brave writer I get to interview today is the incomparable Jane Yolen. Jane is the award-winning author of over 300 books for children, books in fantasy, science fiction, children's picture books, and of course, poetry. Her most famous book, Owl Moon, won the Caldecott Medal in 1988. And listen, if you haven't read it yet, get thee to a library. It is easily one of my favorite children's picture books of all time. I'm looking forward to talking to Jane about her process as a poet. I want to know how she became such a fan of birds and why nature figures so prominently in her work. Her daughter Heidi is also going to join us. Heidi and Jane have collaborated on a series of books, including one that I really love called You Nest Here With Me. If you want your heartstrings tugged, definitely check that book out. So without further ado, let's join Jane and Heidi and see what they have to say about poetry, nature, and the writing life. Jane, thank you so much for being with us today to talk on our Poetry Tea Time podcast. I love the idea of starting with you reading a poem. So if you'd tell us what you're reading, I would love that.
This is from a new book that's just out that I wrote called The Alligator's Smile, with photographs by my son, Jason Stemple, who is an award-winning nature photographer. And he got up close and personal with some of these alligators, a little too close and personal for his mother's feeling. But he assured me that there was a very long lens. Anyway, this one's called The Alligator's Smile. Do not trust a smiling gator. She is thinking now or later. She is plotting how to catch you in a while. When she's done with cogitating, I'm so sorry to be stating, she will have an even greater mile-wide smile.
Oh, that's lovely. Thank you so much. You know, what's fun about what our community represents is that we are a band of homeschoolers who have a love of the arts, but also the natural sciences. And one of the chief habits of our community is to go on nature hikes and to go birding in addition to poetry. And you address both of those so beautifully in your writings. I was really excited to introduce you to the people who haven't met you. I wonder if there is anyone left. But for those who haven't, I really wanted them to be exposed to that intersection between nature and poetry. Maybe you could speak to that a little bit now. How do you find that connection and how does that stimulate you as an artist?
Well, the first thing is to know is that I was not always someone who really understood or felt very deeply about nature. I grew up in New York City, where birds are pigeons or they're not. they call pigeons flying rats. But then I met my husband-to-be, and he was a West Virginia boy. He'd grown up in the mountains of West Virginia, where he went out every day and he was fishing, he was hunting, he was running trap lines, he was looking at birds and other animals through his binoculars. And it was through him that I became a great lover of the natural world. And when we got married and got our first house, we moved to the country. And from then on, it was a love affair with nature. And if you know the book Owl Moon,
yes,
Pa in Owl Moon. And my daughter Heidi, one of three of my children, she's the oldest, she is the child in Owl Moon, and she still goes out owling with a group called the OMG group. And it stands for the Owl Moon Gang. And they go out owling and counting owls on the Christmas bird count for the Audubon Society.
I love that. In fact, Heidi is there with you, isn't she? Would you like to say hi, Heidi?
I am. Hi. Hi.
Yeah. So Heidi, just tell us for a moment how many owls you have counted. You shared that with me and I want to hear our audience to hear.
Well, when I go out owling, it's part of the Audubon Christmas Bird Count. And that is a yearly census that started over 100 years ago when a guy named Frank Chapman decided that he was tired of the way huntsmen were counting birds. And he published an invitation in his magazine, which is now Audubon Magazine, but it was called Bird Lore back then. And he published an invitation for people to count birds with their eyes and ears instead of with their guns. And it started that year and it's been going on for all these years. And there were 25 people that year. And now there are hundreds of thousands of people. I believe you told me you have done it, Eva.
I have with my son, Liam, and we loved it. Yes.
Yes. Well, the owlers are the crazy people. We get up at midnight and we go out until about 7:30 in the morning. And now we live in Massachusetts, so it's very cold when we're out there. And we call owls and we count them. And on my greatest year with the OMG, which was in, I believe, 2013, we counted 67 owls in one night.
That is incredible. And you count them by sight or only by sound or a combination of both?
A combination of both, but we mostly we call them. Remember, it's very dark in the middle of the night.
Yes.
We call them and we hear them. And when we can see them, when we hear them coming in closer to us, we sometimes stick around a little bit longer. And I often actually talk to them and we get to see them. But we usually only see 3 to 7 in that night. So if you can imagine 60 of those birds, we did not actually hear. Would you like me to call my favorite owl?
Yes, please.
Okay. So this is the screech owl and it sounds like this.
Wow. Now, at one point when my husband was doing all the bird calling, he did it either by mouth or sometimes he had some bird call thing. But now everybody does it with tapes from places like either the Audubon Society or tapes from Cornell University's Lab of Natural Sounds. And it's, of course, the owls no longer say, "Who's making that very odd sound? I better investigate." Now they come and they say, "Oh, I better drive that one out of my territory." Or, "Oh, that one sounds like she might be interesting." All sorts of things. We don't know what they're saying. But then we know when we tried to call by mouth what we were saying.
Well, it's quite beautiful to read that book. Of course, Owl Moon is a Caldecott winner and is a classic work of children's picture book fiction, but it's really rooted in a true story. That's what I love about it. And I love your language, which even though this book is not a traditional poetic form, I read it like a long form free verse poem. Is that an accurate reading of how you thought about it as you wrote it?
It is a long form verse, free form verse poem. And I meant it that way because I am actually a poet. But too many people tend to think, especially with children's poetry, that it has to rhyme.
Right.
Not true. Sometimes it rhymes, sometimes it doesn't. It's like sometimes you see an owl, sometimes you don't. I have a little story to tell you. I got one of the textbook people, the textbooks, wanted to reproduce Owl Moon along with 3 or 4 of John Schoner's extraordinary pictures from the book. And so my agent talked to them and they made a contract, etc. We forgot to put something in the contract because when we got the book, they sent us a copy of the book. They had turned it into paragraphs.
Oh.
And I said, "Oh, come on, guys, this is a poem." And they said, many of them who work there are English teachers, they said, "You didn't tell us it was a poem." Well, it's in a poetry format. It's got short lines. It's got space on either side. But yeah, it doesn't rhyme. So from now on, we write when we work with people like that, as we say, it has to be line for line.
Yes. In fact, I love that this is the organic way we got to this point. Because one of the chief questions I get over and over is, what defines a poem? What distinguishes it from prose? And one of the classic answers that we often hear is short lines. I wondered if you could talk to that a little bit. Is there more to it than short lines? And how would you define poetry?
It's not just broken lines. It's not even just breath spaces. It is about compression, about lyrical language. It's about metaphor. It's about simile. It's about observations beyond the normal. By that, I mean, if you just look at a tree and you say, oh, yeah, it's big and brown, that's not a poem. But if you look at a tree and say, it stands like a sentinel in the woods, that's part of a poem. If you say, oh, yeah, the sky's pretty blue today, that's not a poem. But if you say, the sky is a slate upon which birds write their signatures, that's part of a poem.
That's beautiful. I think that the imagery piece does seem to set poetry apart from prose, although sometimes beautifully descriptive prose will include some of those metaphors. So would you say there is something to the cadence of a poem that feels different than a prose paragraph?
That's why I say the lines have to be lyrical.
Ah.
You have to, it's almost as if you could sing them. You don't have to, but it's almost as if you could sing them, because you get to the end of the line and you're ready to just take off into song.
Oh, I love that. Actually, I really love that. I feel like that gives us a felt sense, something you can check in with your own body, as opposed to consulting some manual on what are the properties of a poem. So I'm all about that. That's beautiful. Go ahead.
There's something else. I want to read another poem to you, because we talk about onomatopoeia too, which means the sound is replicating the sound that you're trying to explain.
Yes. In fact, in one of your books, you use swee swash. I think that's in Sky Dogs. And I wrote it down because that's one of my favorites that I've never read before. So onomatopoeia is that exploration of sound. You don't have to already know bow wow for a dog. You get to create it.
Right. Well, this one is called Woodpecker. Woodpecker. And here's how it goes.
Great.
Woodpeck, peck, peck, up the bark, 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 in the day, 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 not the dark, dark, dark. Time to work, 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 flick and fleck, 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 look for bugs, 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 as I peck, peck, peck. The sound of the woodpecker going da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-
ironically, just last week, a woodpecker was pecking the doorknob on my front door. It was such a loud racket. I thought, who is at my door? And when I came out, I saw him, a little downy woodpecker, fly away and alight on the local, you know, maple tree. And I left and closed the door. He came right back, pecked away, and I just let him. I was so delighted by the whole thing. It sounded just like that. That's beautiful.
Perfect example. What they do is very often around here, we have one. When he's in mating season, he goes and he pecks on the what is it?
Metal drain.
The metal drain pipes.
Wow. Yeah, I never knew they did that.
It goes all over. He's really only trying to make a sound there. He's not looking for bugs at that point. He's trying to say to the females in the area, I am the loudest, best guy around. So the metal affords that, just as your door handle did. My woodpecker thing, I was working on this book called Fine Feathered Friends, and Jason, my son, showed me a wonderful picture of a woodpecker, and I said, I'm going to write a poem for him. And then when I was thinking about the poem, the idea of onomatopoeia came to me, because it had to be the sound. That's what we think of immediately when we think of woodpeckers, is that sound.
Yes, and that's a good example of the subject matter dictating the genre or the form, as opposed to starting with an assignment. This is one of the things in Brave Writer, which is my company that teaches writing to homeschool families. One of the things I talk about is the danger of the assignment. You know, this school orientation where we say, write a poem about, rather than starting with the subject matter and allowing the form to come to you as it relates to the subject or to the topic that you want to explore in writing. So I love that as a powerful example of that in your own work. I wondered if you could also address this one quote of yours. You say, poetry is making coal into diamonds, but never forgetting the dark power of the coal. Would you mind expanding on that idea?
I think that we think of poetry as something that's bright and lovely and makes you feel good. But poetry is also very powerful when it explores other feelings or takes you off from your light, bright stuff into suddenly darker or more interesting or deeper waters, so that you're not just saying, that's a pretty little bird, but you're saying, it's a pretty little bird that hangs its prey on barbed wire. That's a northern shrike. Or it's a pretty little bird that eats its body weight, you know, 10 times an hour, which is probably what a hummingbird does. So there are things, the more you write about nature, the more you need to explore the nature of what you're writing about. And nature holds some interesting, difficult moments. I just, this morning, was writing a poem for a friend about a spider that he had seen. And the poem is funny, but it's alluding to the darker nature of spiders, which is that, you know, they wind their prey up and hang them in the web until they're ready to eat them.
Yes.
And they don't kill them. Many of the spiders leave them, you know, the creatures that are in their webs are still alive, wiggling around. So I wrote a humorous poem about how in the spider's eyes, you know, flies are like ham and cheese pies. It's just because we don't think about it when we're eating, we just eat. The spider's not thinking about it either. The spider just eats. And I have one book that's really gruesome. and it's called Last Laughs, Animal Epitaphs. I'm going to read you.
Oh, sounds great.
A couple of the poems there. Swan song, you know, for kids who may not know that a swan song is not about a swan. It's about the last thing you say before you die, right?
Yes. So,
swan song, it's very small. It goes, a simple song. It wasn't long.
That's awesome.
That's it. Or this one is an owl one. It's called Owl Be Seeing You. Hit by a pellet, some other owl cast. He asked, who, quietly as he passed.
Oh, those are brilliant. Yeah. You know, that actually is interesting to me. I was just going to ask you about how your writing creates surprise, both for you and in a reader. I often say that the least taught literary element in writing is surprise, and yet it's essential to every piece of writing. So I'm curious to know how you cultivate that. And I think you're showcasing it a little bit. It's the element of darkness or unexpected relationships. Does that sound right? What kinds of ways do you cultivate surprise in your writing?
That's some of it. I love to use puns to do that too. Here's another one from that book, Woodpecker's Last Hole. Now, contrast this with the first woodpecker poem that I read. One peck too many severed a limb, and that was the end of impeccable him.
Oh my God. You know,
I was not thinking of the word impeccable as I started. But as I got closer to the end of the line, I thought, impeccable. That's a wonderful, funny way. It doesn't mean pecking, but it's used in this poem as pecking. I think that what happens when you use wordplay, not just puns, but wordplay, in poetry is when you build in a lot of surprise.
Yes.
That I would say is one of my bottom line things, wordplay.
But how do you cultivate that in your life? Do you find that that's pretty natural to you? Do you have, yeah.
My daughter is having hysterics over here. Yeah, I'm known as a huge punster. But I find the more I write, now I write a poem a day, send it to 730 some subscribers. Some of them are rhymed verse, some of for children, some of them are rhymed verse for adults, most of them are non-rhymed verse for grown-ups. And the two things I say is to my subscribers is you can pass these on if you get permission from me with the copyright on it. But these are poems still in process. Mm. And I think that one thing that teachers don't really understand about writing is that it is constant process. And kids think that, therefore, that if I write it once and I have to write it one more time for the teacher, I'm done. And all of my poems are constantly in process, even past the time when they're published. Because then I go, oh, wait a minute, I have a better line for that. Or, oh, that doesn't quite work the way I wanted it to. So I had one of my poetry editors sigh as I was rewriting the manuscript one last time. And he said, with this sort of heavy, heavy sigh, when are you going to be done? And I said, when you take these from my hands. Because as long as it's there, I'm going to be working on it. Everything in writing can be made better. And poetry especially, because it's one word after another. In a novel, you can lose a couple of paragraphs and nobody notices it, especially you. But in a poem, every word is so important that if you just get it wrong by a little bit, you've gotten it wrong, period. And you have to go back.
Would you say that that's an enjoyable part of the process for you, being able to go back and improve what's already there?
It's the whole thing for me. It's the whole thing. The Heidi keeps pointing to two poems I wrote, and I have them on bookmarks, which I will send to people if they want them.
Yes.
5 tips on writing a poem. 1, look at the world through metaphor, seeing one tree in terms of another. 2, let 2 words bump up against each other or seesaw on a single line. 3, tell the truth inside out or on the slant. 4, remember that grammar can be a good friend and a mean neighbor. 5, let the poem rhyme in the heart, though not always on the page. And the second one is called A Poem Is. Words running down the page in black script sneakers. Words nudging one another like bumper cars at a fair. Words humming, thrumming, drumming, strumming, an orchestra of sound. Words that take a thought, a wish, a sentiment, a prayer, and then suck out all the hot air. A poem is. They're really 2 very different poems on the very same subject, about writing a poem.
Totally. They have different moods and yet convey a similar trajectory, which is that sort of living, breathing exploration in language. I love those. We would love to share those with our audience. And I also want to make it possible for them to subscribe to your poem a day. I'm like upset at myself that I haven't been on that already for years.
It's not for kids because many of the poems are very adult. But if an adult wants to subscribe,
yes,
and share some of the children's poems with their kids or their students, I'm fine with that.
That's perfect. One of the objectives of Poetry Tea Time, you know, ostensibly it's for children, but what we've discovered always in home education is that one of the people receiving an upgraded education is the parent. And we have discovered that these adults who've been intimidated by poetry, who've had it ruined for them in an English class, are suddenly developing an appetite for poetry on a whole new level because they've engaged with children's poetry first. And so, yeah, I think this could be a really awesome opportunity for them to continue that exploration. I was going to ask you if you could talk briefly before we finish about your two books coming out, The Grumbles. Is that all right to share? Because we spend a lot of time in nursery rhyme and fairy tales with our younger kids in Brave Writer. In fact, my mom, who's a published children's author, she teaches one of our classes and they do an updated version of a nursery rhyme. And Heidi mentioned that you have something similar going on. So I'd be interested in that.
Well, the new one is just coming out any second now. It's called Grumbles from the Town. And I wrote these with Rebecca Kai Dotlitch, who is a wonderful poet. And what we did was we would look at the same nursery rhyme or the same fairy tale and tell it from a different point of view. And I think learning to do points of view in a poem are very interesting. So here is Little Miss Muffet. We all know the poem about Little Miss Muffet. Little Miss Muffet sat on a tuffet eating her curds and whey. Along came a spider and sat down beside her and frightened Miss Muffet away. So there you have it. What do you have in that poem that you could write from a different perspective? Well, you've got the spider. You've got maybe Miss Muffet's hat or Miss Muffet's shoes. You've got maybe the place where she's sitting, the tuffet. Who knows? There are many things that you can use as the viewpoint for your Little Miss Muffet. And I will read you mine, and then I will read you hers. This is Spinning a Tale. She didn't like tuffet. She didn't like lines. She complained of my gossip or web, where it shines. She didn't like whey that I brought for a treat. She said that a spider has too many feet. She was nasty and naughty. I gave her a push. And instead of the tuffet, her tush met a bush. And then this is Rebecca Kai Dotlitch's one. It's called Spider Recalls the Tuffet Fright. So there I was, dangling and spinning like spiders do, minding my own business, watching her chew curdles and clumps below my trapeze. What is that? I asked in my best spider ease. Achoo! I sneezed. She whooped, she wailed, shouted Gesundheit, and bailed.
That is perfect. Those are adorable. And what different voices, each of those poems about the same subject. I love that.
Now, the same thing with Grumbles from the Forest, which was the first one. These are maybe a little more sophisticated, certainly a little darker because it's about fairy tales and they're very dark.
They are dark.
I will tell you the names of some of the ones, and you tell me which fairy tale you would like to do.
Okay.
Sleeping Beauty, Hansel and Gretel, Beauty and the Beast, Gingerbread Boy, Cinderella, Little Mermaid, Jack and the Beanstalk, Princess and the Pea, Rumpelstiltskin, Frog Prince, Snow White, Little Red Riding Hood, Three Billy Goats, Gruff, Thumbelina, The Three Bears.
I think I'd like to hear Hansel and Gretel.
Hansel and Gretel. Okay.
Talk about dark.
Talk about dark. Hansel and Gretel. Where did I... This is my poem. Gretel spies the magic house. We should have known when we tasted the eaves, breaking them off like toffee and cramming them into our mouths, and the dear little windows, the color of coffee and chocolate doorknobs and window panes striped with mint. We should have guessed at the chimney smoke, white marshmallow fluff, taken the hint from the marzipan bricks and the fence posts made of bone rubble, but it was only when we saw the witch that we knew we were in deep, deep trouble. And then this is Rebecca's, outside the gingerbread house. The witch is there, her craggy face peeking from a window of frosting, waiting for our bellies to growl, hoping for our knock, tick-tock, the hour hurries. No worries, no need to fear, dearest Gretel, your brother is here.
Oh, wow. Those gave me chills. That really grabs you right at the end. I'm scared.
Well, that we both chose the scary moment. Isn't that interesting? We could have done the walk in the forest. We could have done home, but we both went right for the fear part of that story. And that story is when you see the witch for the first time and you're conflicted. You're conflicted because she's got candy on the one hand, she's a witch on the other. And so they both address that in very different ways. And you got the little boy boasting, don't worry, you know.
Yes.
Brother is here. And the girl in my poem going, we should have known. We should have known. Boy, are we in trouble.
What a powerful way to look more intimately at what's familiar. It seems to me that you find that a fascinating theme throughout your career, is taking what we already know and bringing it into a different vision.
It's called observation. You know, we're so used to these days looking at television, which has done its observing for us. Mm. What we're doing is seeing through the eye of that particular lens. We're not allowed to look in any other direction. But a good poem will allow you not only to look through that lens, but to look over to the left, over to the right. And if you're writing poetry, you have to be the best observer of all. You have to open yourself to the universe in a way that will make you a better poet. But that having been said, I want to remind kids, just as I remind my own adult students who are trying to write for kids, you have to give yourself permission to write badly at the beginning. You have to know that what you first put down is not going to be perfect. It needs to be revised. It needs to be thought. Sometimes it needs to be thrown away and started again. Because if you don't give yourself permission to write badly at the beginning, you're going to be writing badly all the way through.
Mm. That's absolutely true. And I also am glad that you highlighted that the fun part of writing for you is the revision process. I often share with my students that the getting down of those initial words is the part that feels like you're, you know, laboring, pulling hand over hand. But once you've got words there, there's so much we can do with them. We can move them around. We can transform them. We can add them. We can delete them. And there becomes this sort of creator power that takes over, that isn't just dredging from, you know, the blank nothingness. So I'm really happy that you have expressed that that's what you love too, because I think it takes multiple voices to persuade people that that's actually the juice of writing. go ahead, Jane.
I think that writing is the malleable art.
Mm.
You can twist it and take it and shake it and shape it over and over and over again. And it never goes off. You know, if you're a potter and you work too much on a piece of clay, at some point you have to throw the clay away because it doesn't work anymore. You've overworked it. So I think that with words, you can come back the next day and the next day and the next day after that and reshape it and reformat it and reform it. And it becomes, one hopes, better. Or if it doesn't become better, you can then go back and start it again the next week or the next month. I have files full of stuff I've started that I go back to maybe a year or two later because I maybe wasn't ready to really find the heart of the matter.
Absolutely. Oh, absolutely. In fact, I think writers keep collections of writing. I'm in the process of working on a book right now, and I find myself remembering things I've written 5 and 6 years ago. You go search, you find that piece, you didn't know what to do with it then. I mean, that's part of the wool gathering of writing, I think, that is actually liberating to know that you have cultivated a history of words. In fact, I wanted to ask you, what is one writing dream that you have yet to fulfill? You've done so many different kinds of writing. Is there a new vision or something that you'd like to explore that you haven't yet explored?
I'd love to write a Broadway play.
Oh.
I think I'm going to. I've written smaller plays that have been produced here and there. I've written a couple of very short films. But I think a Broadway musical would be fun to do, but it's not going to happen.
Oh,
I know that. And it's because it's a much more collaborative thing than writing a poem, writing a novel. Yes, you do some collaboration when you're working with an editor, with an art director, with a publisher. But when you're working in theater, it is collaborating with so many people who can change or rework your stuff, even without you there, that I'm not sure I have the wherewithal to deal with that.
That makes sense. Well, you've certainly made a huge contribution to the world of literature that we all love and appreciate. I wanted to close by telling you that the book, You Nest Here With Me, made me cry when I read it. It is the perfect blend of intimacy of parent to child, plus a huge description of a variety of familiar backyard birds and their habitats. And I thought that our listeners in particular would really enjoy it. You Nest Here With Me. So thank you for that. And I know, Jane, that's you and your daughter, Heidi, who put that together with each other. And I love that. I love this whole collaborative process of writing with your mother and daughter. I have done a little bit of that with my own mom. So I really appreciate you coming on this show with us today and being a part of our Poetry Tea Time celebration. Thank you so much.
Well, my pleasure. And thanks for having me and for having Heidi be a stealth visitor.
She's been great. I enjoyed getting to know her. So that was fun. If you're interested in any of the books or resources mentioned on today's interview, go to poetryteatime.com, click on Poetry Corner, and locate the blog post associated with this interview. We post the show notes there. If you're new to Poetry Tea Time, I invite you to download our free quick start guide. Go to poetryteatime.com and same thing, head to the top of the page and click on the link. If you love Instagram, and I certainly do, please follow me. My account is @poetryteatime. Today's podcast was produced by the Brave Writer Podcast, A Brave Writer's Life in Brief. If you enjoyed it, we would love you to leave us a review on iTunes. That's how we spread the word. In the meantime, put the kettle on, make some treats, stack up the poetry books, and enjoy a magical family time of learning. I'm Julie Bogart, and I look forward to the next time we meet on this podcast.